If you want to open in your Bibles to Matthew 17, and as I usually do in this period of our study, I'll give you three references, Matthew 17, Mark 9, and Luke 9. So we're studying in the life of Christ for those who are visiting with us. And to set the context of where we're at in the life of Christ, we're studying things chronologically. So we're jumping between the four Gospels. That's why we give references to each of the contexts where we're studying. But we studied last week about Jesus, and he healed a boy who had a demon. It was very violent. He would throw him down. He would throw him into the fire. But this happened after Jesus had come from where? Well, he had just come from the Mount of Transfiguration. So he had just come down from the mountain with Peter, James, and John, and he comes into the city, and there are the nine apostles, and they're arguing with the scribes and the Pharisees. And we talked about the lack of faith, and Jesus pointed out that it was a perverse and unbelieving generation. We pointed out last week who had exhibited a lack of faith in that situation. Well, we pointed out it was both the apostles, because they wondered why they could not do it. But it was the Father also who said, help my unbelief. And so there was unbelief on behalf of both. But this is the context that leads us into our study tonight. I mentioned last week we're going to study, and we're going to talk about what Jesus said about a question to him about paying taxes. But remember the greater context. As I said, he had been up on the Mount of Transfiguration, in which he appeared in his glorified state with Moses and Elijah. And that had come after the first time at the end of Matthew chapter 16. And we need to remember this. At the end of Matthew 16, he had told his apostles, I'm going to suffer, I'm going to be crucified, and then I'll be raised from the dead. And the first time he said that, Peter said what? Get behind me. No, I'm sorry. He said, God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you. And that's where Jesus responded to Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. We pointed out last week, and we'll cover this real quick, that he said it to him a second time. And it was a much different reaction. So that kind of sets the context for what we're studying tonight. And again, anybody has a question, comment as we study along, please unmute yourself and speak up. So in Matthew chapter 17, I want to start there. And James, do you want to go ahead and mute yourself and read that for us?
Matthew 17, 24 to 27. And they were come to Capernaum. They that received the half shekel came to Peter and said, doth not your teacher pay the half shekel? He saith, yea. And when he came into the house, Jesus spake first to him, saying, what thinkest thou, Simon? The kings of the earth, from whom do they receive toll or tribute? From their sons or from strangers? And when he said, from strangers, Jesus said unto him, therefore the sons are free. But lest we cause them to stumble, go thou to the sea, cast a hook, take up the fish that first cometh up, and when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a shekel. That take and give unto them for me and thee.
All right. One other thing, before we proceed in our study tonight, I want to remind where we're at in the life of Christ. We talk about the ministry of Jesus Christ as being about 3 to 3.5 years. There are four Passovers that are mentioned. We are, if you see this little star that I put down here, this is approximately on the timeline where we're at. We've talked about three Passovers already. We're now within, as you can see down here, we're now within about 6 months of his death, his burial, and his resurrection. He is on his way now to Jerusalem in the grand scheme of things. And that is why he is talking about what is going to happen to him. And as we pointed out last week in Mark chapter 9, verses 30 and 31, from there they went out and began to go through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know about it. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. Luke adds, before Jesus' declaration, let these words sink into your ears. And we talked last week how that Jesus wants them to stop and think about this. They're having trouble processing these words. But he wants them to stop and to think about what he's saying to them. It's similar to what we're studying in Revelation on Sunday, and the statement that is made to all seven churches, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. We need to think about these words that he has to say, and he wants his apostles to think about them carefully. Because Jesus, as I mentioned, had told them already in Mark chapter 8 and verse 31, where Peter began to rebuke the Lord. And here we pointed out that when they heard this, they did not understand the statement, and they were afraid to ask. And that Luke records it was concealed from them, so they might not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about this statement. We talked about why is it or how is it that it was concealed from them so that they did not understand. And we made reference to 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and how that he wrote to the Corinthians and told them that because you're thinking naturally, physically, temporally, you're thinking from a fleshly perspective. He said in verse 14 of 1 Corinthians 2 that he cannot understand the things that I'm teaching because they're spiritually appraised. And when the disciples had a physical, carnal concept of the kingdom, this aspect of the king being crucified, it did make sense to them. And Matthew adds in Matthew 17, verse 23, that they were deeply grieved. Deeply grieved because their prospect was that Jesus was going to sit on the literal throne, that he was going to reign as a physical king, and him pronouncing that he was going to suffer and die upon the cross. This caused them to grieve, and which was very different than Peter's reaction, as I mentioned, the first time. Then that leads us to the text that James just read in verses 24 through 27, that they came to Capernaum. Now, Capernaum was a city that was often kind of referred to as Jesus' second home. It was there that he often went to. He spent a lot of time in the city of Capernaum. But what do we know? What had Jews from Jerusalem come up to the Sea of Galilee and the city of Capernaum? What did they come up in Matthew chapter 15 to ask Jesus about his disciples? Does anybody remember what they had come all the way from Jerusalem up there to the Sea of Galilee to ask him?
Yes. They asked him why his disciples didn't wash their hands before they ate.
And really at the heart of that was, why aren't they following the traditions that we have set up? They had traveled all the way by foot from Jerusalem up to the Sea of Galilee. And they wanted to know why our authority is not being followed, the traditions that we have set up. That was in the area of Capernaum. They're back now. And he is back in Capernaum, and there's more questions now by those that are challenging Jesus. They're looking for inconsistencies. They are looking for reasons to discredit Jesus Christ. They're looking for accusations to make against him. And when they came to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? Is Peter, and Peter said, yes, he does. It's in Exodus chapter 30, and you can read that context. I'm not going to take the time tonight to read these Old Testament contexts, but in Exodus chapter 30, verses 12 through 16, and 2 Chronicles 24:6, it's interesting, Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 32, Nehemiah writes after they have come back from Babylonian captivity, and he is reinstituting the tax that was set up in Exodus chapter 30. And let me jump ahead. It was called the half shekel tax, or simply in the ESV, it's called the tax. The New King James Version uses the phrase the temple tax. This is not the poll tax. The poll tax referred to in Matthew 22, and let's go ahead and jump to Matthew chapter 22 because we need to kind of think about this in the same context. In Matthew 22, let's begin in verse 15. And Richard, could you read verses 15 through 22 of Matthew 22?
Then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might ensnare him in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that thou art true and teach us the way of God in truth, and carest not for anyone, for thou regardest not the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar, or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness, and said, Why make ye trial of me, ye hypocrites? Show me the tribute money. And they brought unto him a denarius. And he said unto them, Whose is this image and superscription? And they say unto him, Caesar's. Then saith he unto them, Render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. And when they heard it, they marveled, and left him, and went away.
All right, so when this question came up in Matthew 22 about this, in verse 17, the New American Standard uses the phrase a poll tax. This poll tax was a Roman tax. That's why Jesus said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. What is being talked about here in Matthew chapter 17 is two drachma tax. Was that a Roman tax? No. That was a Jewish tax for the maintenance and service, as it were, of the temple. Let me jump ahead to this slide where Foss's Bible Dictionary says each Israelite paid a half shekel as atonement money for the service of the tabernacle, the morning and evening sacrifice, the incense, the wood, the showbread, the red heifers, the scapegoat, etc. And this became an annual payment on the return from Babylon, as I referenced Nehemiah. So this was for the maintenance and service of the temple. This was what Jews were responsible for providing and paying. But at the same time, we need to understand that there were multiple forms of taxation. And what I'm going to read you is simply from Nelson's Illustrated Bible Dictionary. And Nelson says, when the Romans under Pompey captured Jerusalem in 63 BC, a tax of 10,000 talents was temporarily imposed on the Jews. The tax contracting system, I've read in other places that the tax system at that time was actually referred to as tax farming. You know, that people were ascribed a geographic area that they were responsible for, as it were, harvesting taxes. So he says the tax contracting system was reformed by Julius Caesar, who reduced the taxes and levied no tax in the Sabbatic years. But soon after the Herods came to power in Palestine, they demanded heavy taxes. The Herods instituted a poll tax and a tax on fishing rights in the rivers and lakes. You know, Mickey's not with us, but I'm sure that would be horrible, wouldn't it? He went on to say customs were collected on trade routes by men like Levi or Matthew, who collected in Capernaum. This city may also have been a place for port duties and fishing tolls. Some items sold for 1,000% above their original prices because of all the taxes. There may have been sales tax on slaves, oil, clothes, hides, furs. Over and above these taxes were the religious dues, this temple tax that is being referred to here. These were generally between 10 and 20% of a person's income before the government tax. And Nelson went on to say during Jesus' time, the Jews were probably paying from 30 to 40% of their income on taxes and religious dues. So we talk about and we complain about our tax structure and, you know, how burdensome it is. They understood the burden of a tax system. There were Roman taxes and there were Jewish taxes. And here, as I said, we are talking about the Jewish taxes. It's interesting, Peter's simple response to their question, does your teacher pay the two drachma tax? He simply says yes. No elaboration. We read in context like Romans 13, 1 through 7, 1 Peter 2, chapter 2, verses 13 through 17. In Romans chapter 13, Paul addresses the aspect of tax to whom tax is due. The simple answer to the question, are Christians to pay their taxes today? Yes, we are. We may not like it. It may not be a joyous thing to do. But it is something that even in Jesus' day, it was something that was very important. And as we read in Matthew chapter 22, it was an avenue they thought they could get to Jesus here regarding the temple tax. They thought they could get to Jesus, find an inconsistency, find a reason, and we're going to observe it in the next slide. Their way to create a scandal. They thought they could create something, create a news story here, because the efforts against to try and, as it were, attack Jesus as the Christ are beginning and growing. So we can cover that. And in, as was read a moment ago, it was noted that when he came into the house, that is Peter. So Peter's outside answering this question. Peter comes into the house, and Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers?" So Jesus uses the expression of the poll tax. That is the Roman form of taxation. But he's talking about the temple tax that Peter had been questioned about. And he says, "Peter, who do they collect that tax from?" Now, unlike our modern system of taxation, in which it's supposed to be that the taxes fall evenly on all people, on all citizens. Citizens pay taxes in our current time. Unlike the modern system of paying taxes, a sales tax or something like that, Jesus draws here the attention to the practice of many ancient nations to collect taxes from strangers, from foreigners, and not from their own citizens, and certainly not from the ruling family, as it were, of a government. That is their own children, the expression is used here, or even perhaps their own citizenship, or the royal family, perhaps. And Jesus asked Peter, what was the general practice in their time? And Peter, understanding the general practice in his day, says, "Well, in our day," Peter says, "you collect the customs or the taxes from strangers, from the foreigners, not from the royal family, not from the citizenry." Now, that kind of seems foreign to us a little bit. We understand that as citizens, we pay the taxes on, the taxes are imposed on all the citizens. But the practice at that time was that the burden of taxation was generally placed upon foreigners. And Peter answered that way. He said, "from strangers." Jesus said to him, "then the sons are exempt." That is, if you were a member of the royal family, did the members of the royal family then pay taxes? Well, it may not seem right to us, but that's the way it was at that time. And Jesus then, speaking of this religious duty, this is something imposed upon Jews at that day for the service of the temple. And remember, who were the Jews going to the temple to honor, to worship, and to praise? They were going there to praise and honor and worship God. What had just been pronounced upon the Mount of Transfiguration, that voice that came from the cloud that enveloped Jesus and Peter and James and John while Jesus talked with Moses and Elijah? What did the voice from heaven say?
"This is my son, who I'm well pleased. Hear ye him."
"This is my beloved son." Jesus is aligning himself with the sons in this context, in the previous verse, as the beloved son of God. Would it make sense for the son of God, whom the Jews would go to worship in the temple, that the son of God would pay a temple tax to worship his father, that he sat at the right hand of before he willingly came to this earth to live and to die for us? Jesus' point is, the son does not pay tax to the father. It's hard perhaps to understand, and like I said, it's contrary to our system, our mindset of how taxes work. But it does make sense, does it not, from a spiritual perspective, that the Son of God would not pay a temple tax to honor his Father, the Creator of all mankind? But what does Jesus go on to say? Again, why are they asking Peter this? Are they simply inquisitive? Is it just a survey? Are they just, you know, we just want to know? Or are they trying to create a story here?
Chris?
Yes.
I think it's easier to understand from the, you mentioned earlier about the royal standpoint. It's easier to understand that the prince wouldn't pay the king more so than the son wouldn't pay the father. It's just easier to grasp.
Sure.
The royal family doesn't pay taxes. They receive taxes.
Right.
And so I just think that that's an easier way to look at it.
Absolutely. Yeah. The prince of the King of Kings, the son of the Creator of all mankind does not pay taxes to his spiritual father. But what it is, James, as you read a moment ago, what did Jesus go on to say? Because Jesus knew what was in their heart. He knew why they were questioning Peter outside the house. And he continued to say to Peter, however, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea and throw in a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for you and me. Now, we've seen this word offend, and when it's a word I think that gets abused in our language today. I'm offended, and I take offense at that, and it means our feelings are hurt. Does this word offend mean getting your feelings hurt? It actually means to cause to stumble. And if you remember, it comes from the Greek word skandalizo, from which we get our English word scandalize. And literally what Jesus is saying, so that we don't cause a scandal here, so we don't create a stir, that we don't create unnecessary controversy. He's already said, does Jesus need to pay the temple tax? No. But he said, you know what we're going to do, Peter? I'm going to have you go throw a hook into the Sea of Galilee, and you're going to catch a fish. And that first fish that you catch, you're going to open its mouth, and you're going to find a shekel. And you're going to take that shekel, and you're going to give it to them as the temple tax for you and me, so that we don't offend, so that we don't cause anyone to stumble, so we don't scandalize anybody. I want to point out, was Jesus simply about not creating offenses? Was he just trying to, as it were, create a, you know, just go through life smoothly and make sure that his ministry didn't create any ripples, any? Well, no, because let's go back a few weeks. Remember in John chapter 6, and this is where we talked about this word to scandalize or to stumble. In John chapter 6, what happened when Jesus talked about himself being the bread of life and that you need to eat my flesh and drink my blood? And eventually, after he had talked with them about the need to eat my flesh and drink my blood, the multitude that was before him, what did they do over that teaching? They stumbled and they turned and walked no longer with him. And that's where we know that at the end of that chapter, he basically asked his disciples, did this cause you to stumble also? Are you going to go away also? And we know that's where Peter said, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. I just want to point out that Jesus was willing to be scandalous, as it were, with the word of truth. Not scandalous from the perspective of just trying to stir up controversy, but he preached the truth. He preached what they needed to hear. And when people with a fleshly mindset couldn't absorb and couldn't process what he was teaching, he didn't change his teaching. He didn't change the method in order not to offend. He didn't call them back and say, wait, don't leave. But when it came to this temple tax, In the words of Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 15, Jesus silences the ignorance of foolish men. He's not going to let this be an issue. He's not going to let, well, see, there Jesus is not paying the temple tax. I knew there was something that we could discredit him for. But he then paid the tax. And it's an interesting lesson on the insistence of our rights. Jesus had the right not to pay that tax because God was his father. As Randy, you pointed out, he was the royal son. But I want to point out, how did he pay this temple tax? He did it by telling Peter to do something that none of us would ever think to come up with, the manner in which to pay. He said, go, as I said, go put your line in the sea, and the first fish you're going to find, there's going to be a coin in his mouth, and it's going to be enough for you to pay the temple tax for you and for me. I'd like to point out that this not only is a lesson on the understanding the need to exercise our liberties appropriately, but it's a reminder of who he is, the Son of God, by the means of how the tax was paid. You and I couldn't pay the tax in this way, could we? I couldn't tell anybody to go and cast a line into the sea and pull up a fish and you're going to find the means to pay the tax. There only Jesus could. And so in paying the tax in this way, he not only took away the scandal, he proved who he was. An interesting lesson for us to learn, both in terms of who he is and the focus he had on establishing his kingdom and what he had to do to go to Jerusalem now as he was on his way to do. Any questions, comments about the payment of this temple tax?
Chris?
Yes.
Yeah. I think a lot of times, well, of course, the low-hanging fruit right now is whether we should wear a mask or not. You know, we have a right one way or the other. And I think these kinds of things speak to that pick your battles thing. There are some things that are important and some things that are not. But I think that it also goes into when we're talking to other people about Christ. The thing that they need to know is that he exists and he died for them and what they need to do. They don't need to know when you first start out if there's a rapture. They don't need to know when you first start out about a lot of things. And I think a lot of times we just go for the thing when what we need to do is lay a foundation, build a foundation of trust. Yeah. And go to the greater truth, and then we can deal with all the other stuff later. But if they're not baptized, none of that other stuff matters anyway. And I think that this is sort of him saying that. Stick with what really is important, and let's just not cause any doors to close before we get to the important stuff.
Yeah, no, I think you're right in pointing out it has to do with the exercise of liberties, what we're free to do or to not do. Jesus was not mandated to pay this tax, but in order for it to not be an issue, and what this reminded me of is, as we have been, some of us been studying on Tuesday nights about Timothy, in Acts chapter 16, Paul took Timothy on with him on the second missionary journey. What did Paul have Timothy do before he took him with him?
He had him get circumcised.
He had him circumcised. Why?
Because it pleased the Jews.
Well,
they could take him into the temple.
So they could take him into the synagogue, so that wouldn't be an issue. Let's take that issue off the table. I need you there with me. Let's not have circumcision being an issue. Did it as a servant of Christ, does it matter if we're circumcised or uncircumcised? No.
No.
But in order to effectively use Timothy to have him circumcised so that I can go into the synagogue so we can teach and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ together. And as he talked about in the book of, in the letter, in the First Corinthian letter, that by all means, I might save some. You know, that I'm going what was the expression? To the Jews, I became as a Jew. To the Greeks, as a Greek. Why? Just because he tried to blend in? No, that he might save some, that he might relate to other people, both Jew and Gentile, and teach to them the gospel of Jesus Christ. So an important lesson for us as we think about the exercising of our liberties, what we may or may not do, that it's not a matter of pleasing God, but it is a matter of pleasing God, because one of the things we're going to look at here in this next context is putting stumbling blocks in other people's way. Can we do something that we have a liberty to do that the Word of God hasn't said, don't do that, but we do it and it causes somebody else to stumble? It causes somebody else to sin. And so we can, and we need to be very, very careful about that. So let's read now. I'm going to turn to Mark's account in Mark chapter 9. And let's just start by reading 33 through 37. Mark 9, 33 through 37. And they came to Capernaum, and when he, that is Jesus, was in the house, he began to question them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." Taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him into his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me." If you go back to Matthew chapter 18, let me read the first few verses of Matthew chapter 18, verses 1 through 6. "And at that time the disciples came to Jesus and said, 'Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' And he called a child to himself and set him before them and said, 'Truly I say to you, unless you are converted,'" and note these words, "'and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven.'" And finally, we'll read more from Matthew in a moment, but in Luke's account, in Luke chapter 9, and in verse 46, notice this. Luke's account says, "An argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart, took a child and set him by his side." And then the rest of the context. So first of all, note they came to Capernaum when he was in the house. As a child, do you ever remember your parents perhaps getting wind of what you and your siblings are talking about, and perhaps perceiving it's not what you should be talking about? But they come into Capernaum, and Jesus then questions the 12, and does Jesus know what's in their heart? He knows what they're thinking, as we pointed out already. And he began to question them, "What were you talking about as we came to Capernaum?" Have you ever had a conversation with someone that you didn't want revealed to other people? As we pointed out here, whoops, I got them out of order again. Luke tells us, and you know, it was an argument that started. And Mark, as we pointed out, they kept silent. When Jesus asked them, "What were you discussing?" they wouldn't answer. Because what they had been talking about, what they had been arguing about, was something they knew the Lord would not be happy with. They were ashamed of what they had been asking about, but Jesus knew what they were thinking in their heart. Let's put this again into context. That's the importance of studying the life of Christ in chronological context. Remember Matthew 16, Peter had gone ahead of the Lord and said, "Lord, this will never happen to you." And Jesus said to Peter, "Get behind me." And then talked about how we get behind him, deny ourselves, take up our cross, and follow after him. Get behind me. So to put this into context, if the apostles had to get behind Jesus, what were they then jockeying for? Well, if I'm going to be behind Jesus, I want to be the first one. I want to be the one right behind him. I want to be in front of everybody else but behind Jesus. And I'm going to focus on making sure that I have my place of honor. I have my place of respect. This word started, Randy, you have the New American Standard. Do you see note the footnote there for the word started?
Which passage are you looking at?
In Luke chapter 9.
Forty-six.
Right.
An argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest.
Right. You see the footnote there?
Footnote entered in.
Yes. It entered in among them. Who do you think entered in the thoughts of preeminence and pride and arrogance amongst the 12 apostles?
It was the enemy.
The enemy did that. Our adversary. He put the idea into the head, aren't you better than Peter and James and John? Why did those three get to go up? Aren't you better? We need to respect the efforts of Satan here to stir the pot, to get pride in the way.
Yes.
They were going to focus on, okay, I'm following after Jesus, but I'm going to be first behind him. Satan is the, remember, Satan means the accuser. Do you remember in Genesis chapter 1, the Garden of Eden? Who did Satan accuse in Genesis chapter 1? Satan accused God.
Yes.
And when you think about Job chapter 1 and 2, on the other hand, you read in Revelation chapter 12, verses 11 and 12, that he is the accuser of our brethren. In the book of Job, who does Satan accuse before God? But Job himself.
Yes.
He goes to God and said, you know, the only reason Job is serving you is because you protected him. There's no real loyalty there. There's no faithfulness there. You take away his physical blessings and he'll curse you to your face. We see Satan at work here amongst the 12 apostles, accusing each of them that perhaps the other one thinks they're better. What is Jesus trying to get his 12 to think about? What has twice now in this recent times, as we point out, twice he has tried to get them to think about what? I'm going to suffer. I'm going to be killed. I'm going to be betrayed. I'm going to be crucified. And then I'm going to rise from the dead. Think about that. Remember, let these words sink into your ears. Think about this. And immediately they're thinking about what? Who's better? Who's more important? How disappointing that had to be to Jesus to know that as he's trying to get them focused on what sacrifice he is going to make, that while he is thinking about sacrifice, they're thinking about pride. And these words that they're arguing amongst each other, as we studied Matthew 15 verses 18 and 19 recently, the words coming out of their mouth reflect what? Reflects their heart. It reflects how they think. It reflects that they're comparing themselves with themselves. They're putting together their list of, well, I've got this and I do this and this is my strength and this is why I'm better. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12, Paul talks about the foolishness of comparing ourselves to other people. Rather, who should they have been comparing themselves to but the Lord whom they were following? What was Jesus' response? How did he respond to this pride that he knew that he created the argument among them? We see in Mark chapter 9, verse 35, he sat down and he called the 12 to him and said to them, if anyone wants to be first, he should be last of all and servant of all. Say last in what sense? Someone summarize for me what Philippians chapter 2 verses 3 and 4 says. Richard, you remember that?
Let me see. That's Philippians 2, 3, and 4, doing nothing through faction or through vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, each counting other better than himself, not looking each of you to his own things, but each of you also to the things of others.
And then he uses who as an example in verse 5 and following?
Jesus himself.
Jesus himself. So when we talk about last in what sense, it means considering others more important than ourselves, that we consider the interests of others, and we use Jesus as our example, who considered us and not himself, in that context of Philippians 2, of leaving the right hand of God and taking the form of a bondservant. Notice in Mark 9:35, the words servant of all and last of all, who does that include? Don't say everybody. Would that include our enemies? Would that include family? Would that include brethren? Would that include those who treat us well? Would that include those who don't treat us well? Would that include those to whom have who have invited us into their homes and those that have refused to do so? My point is that when he says servant of all, they have to consider, even beyond just the 12 of them, that their responsibility as apostles of Jesus Christ, as disciples of Christ, was to be a servant of all, to be last of all, and to understand that if one truly seeks preeminence, the irony or the contrast is preeminence comes through humility and service. We will study later on as we come to John chapter 13 how that Jesus powerfully demonstrated this to his apostles who still hadn't yet. By the time we get to John 13, they still haven't understood this lesson when he washes their feet and tells them, as I have done to you, you do to each other. But he went on to say, and he called a child to himself and set him before them and said, truly I say to you, unless you are converted. That term converted means what? Go ahead, Daphne.
Unless you become changed or transformed.
Changed, absolutely. You have to change, and change what? Your heart, your mind, your attitude. And be converted and become like children. And notice these words. What's at stake here? They're all worried about, again, as they will express later, we want to sit on your right and left in the kingdom. Doesn't this have to be a little bit shocking for him to tell his apostles, you might not even be part of this kingdom unless you change, unless you be converted and become like children? You will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Don't worry about sitting on my right and left. You're not even going to be part of it unless you change your heart and humble yourselves as this child. That the one who is able to do that is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. I can't emphasize this enough. Their entrance into the kingdom of heaven was in jeopardy. Their ability to be part of this kingdom that Jesus came to establish, that would be established just within a matter of probably, like I said, about 7-8 months. Their entrance was in jeopardy unless they changed. Pride and arrogance, we need to remember, stand in opposition to love. We know the passages. We know Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before stumbling. We need to know verse 20 of Proverbs 16, that he goes on to say, he who gives attention to the word will find good, and blessed is he who trusts in the Lord. But pride goes before destruction. We will not enter the kingdom of heaven with pride and arrogance. At an individual level, in Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 16, he uses it to describe the nation of Edom and says, of Edom, arrogance of your heart has deceived you. That's the thing about arrogance and pride. It's so deceptive that we fall prey and we don't notice that. We need to understand pride and arrogance will deceive our own hearts. And we need to understand that we need to change. We must be converted if we're going to have any prospect of being part of the kingdom that Jesus came to establish. We note in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 6 how that Paul understood that in his preaching of the gospel, he pointed out that it would, he needed to keep his thinking in check when he said, "Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, so that in us you may learn not to exceed what is written, so that no one of you will become arrogant in behalf of one against the other." That's our goal, is that we understand and we subject ourselves to the word of God, that we don't lift ourselves up, and that they need to humble themselves. And we know these two passages and hopefully committed them to memory. James chapter 4, James talks about the need to draw near to God. As he says that in verse 8, it begins in verse 6 by saying, "But he gives a greater grace. Therefore it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you." So we need to understand that at the heart of being a member of the kingdom, to be a Christian within the Lord's church, it means that we have this humble heart. We know that Peter, as he talks about the roaring lion who seeks to devour, he says in verse 1 Peter 5, "Therefore humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, so that he may exalt you at the proper time." Now is not the proper time to be exalting themselves, casting all your anxiety upon him because he cares for you, and to be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion. We need to appreciate the challenge Jesus has, and I want to leave with you. Think about these words as we prepare for next week's lesson, which we're going to continue to talk about true greatness and then what it means to be a stumbling block. But notice the key words that Jesus used in this context. He used the word last. He used the word servant. He used the word converted. He used the word humble. And we're going to talk, and I want you to think about, Lord willing, we'll talk about what he meant when he said to become like children. There are some childlike qualities that we need to put on. And to prepare for that, I would challenge you and ask you to read, if you want to make a note of this, Psalms 131. Psalms 131, it's a short psalm. But if you will read that before next week's class, I think it has a lot to say about what it means to become like children.